Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Team Liquid Strategies show Strat Chat. Today we're going to be talking about map control and how that relates to gameplay. All right, hey guys, what's up?
Hey Chris, how's it going?
Doing good? Tao, there.
Hello.
Hello,
Let's go ahead and go around and introduce ourselves real quick. Oops, there we go. Are you too, Taya?
hello. Hello, I'm Tioita on Team Liquid. I've been a staff member for like, I guess, 2 years now, and I've worked on TL stuff for a bit over that. And I was one of the first who started the Team Liquid strategy section of the staff. And I guess that's about it. I play Protoss, so I'm biased. That's also important. Yeah, that's it, I guess.
Hi everyone, I'm Whitewing. Out of everyone here, I'm the newest member of Team Liquid Strategy.
The beardiest.
I've written a small number of articles for it, worked on a number of other things. I'm an economist, and I play random. So.
Right, excellent. My name's John. I am the lower bottom left-hand corner, for those of you who don't know. that's me. I read a lot for Team Liquid, and I haven't done so as much recently because I've been kind of on hiatus from StarCraft 2. Who knows what the future will hold, but mostly I've been playing League of Legends. Still, I do know something about
So passionate.
StarCraft.
Yeah, what a terrible person.
All right, I'm Jer99 from Team Liquid. I do a lot of Terran things. I did some interviews at WCS Toronto. They're on Team Liquid's YouTube page if you want to check them out. Then you'll see my face. I'm also on the stream right now. I'm in the picture with the dog. That's from like 4 years ago though, so it's kind of outdated. And yeah, I do a lot of Terran shit for Team Liquid. I've been staff for, I want to say, just under a year now, maybe 9 months. So yeah, that's me.
All right, why don't you start off
Yeah,
the
it's gonna be.
discussion, Joel? What are we talking about today?
All right, so today we're just going to talk about the strategic concept of map control, how it's applied, when it's applied, how to use it, and how it relates to game design as well, and what influences it has on the current Legacy of the Void beta as well. So start off with a brief explanation of what map control is. So why don't we have Jeremy give his ideas on what that is to start with?
All right, so my perception of map control is really just, there's, yet physical map control. So when you actually have your units on the map and stuff with vision, vision plays a big part of that. And there's also the, there's kind of a mind game to it too. Like say you see a stalker outside your base, you're like, uh-oh, he kind of has map control, even though he might not necessarily have anything else out on the map, kind of thing. So there's really two big parts of that, I think. There's a physical aspect to it, and then there's also just the mental aspect to having map control. So you can also further break that down into the physical one. So you can have, your ground control. You might have a big ground army, but then there's also the air control. So you might have units on the ground, but if, say, in TVT, the enemy has a sky turret army, right? And you just have like sea chains and shit left on the ground, then you're obviously going to have ground control, but then you have to back off because you might have banshees and stuff in the air. So that's just kind of a brief summary of my perception of map control in general.
When I think of map
Okay.
control, I think of like taking control of the map so that you can do objectives, right? So in StarCraft 2, I think of something like, you take map control, you kind of force your opponent back so that you can take more expansions or have freedom to attack or whatever. It's what it allows you to take objectives and do things.
All right, so yeah, map control is basically the notion of controlling space in the map, allowing your ally, allowing you to move your tools or units or pieces or whatever, depending on what game you're playing, around the board more freely, while also preventing your opponent from making similar movements. Jeremy mentioned air control and ground control, which are, you know, very important to distinguish between the two. Because you can, you know, if you've got a siege tank choke outside your opponent's natural, he might not be able to move out by ground, but he can still probably drop you. So, hey, no problem. somebody said something in chat. So, yeah, basically map control is just allowing you to move out of the map and controlling where your opponent can move, and thereby, by coincidence, allowing you additional movement on the map. So that's how I would define it. Teo?
Yeah, I think the simplest definition is just the ability to be basically wherever you want on the map with your army. That's, I think, the simplest way you can put it. So, for example, if you're in a situation where you're doing a defensive strategy, you give up map control. And if you're doing an offensive strategy, by definition, you're always on the map. And that opens up not only attacking, but a bunch of other things, like, as you guys have mentioned, taking expansions, attacking to things behind your map control, whatever. So it's a tool to have more options, I guess, at the end of the day, by being able to be on the map. Yeah.
Everyone agree with that?
Yeah, I think that's more or less.
Summarization, yeah.
All right, good. That was fast. All right, so...
we're trying to move forward from the first episode.
Yeah, better than last time.
Okay, so that's what map control is. So why don't we discuss why map control is an important concept? And I think I'll probably start this one out by saying that map control is important because it enables you to use your units to their fullest, and it reduces your and gives you more options. It gives you positioning advantages, and it prevents your opponent from having the same options. It takes options away from your opponent. If you can move out to any position in the map you want and your opponent can't leave his own base, he's going to have a really tough time getting anything done, whereas you can do pretty much whatever you want. So.
Yeah, I agree with that.
I think there's two things to it. The first is the actual strategic implications of being able to expand or attack or whatever. But it also just feels good when you're playing to be on the map. Like, I don't know. Personally, I feel like I almost play better when I have map control because I feel free to do whatever I want. It's a psychological thing rather than an actual ability to do things. But it just feels good, I guess. Mm-hmm. Which it's why a lot of players, for example, in PvP like Blink, or why lots of Terrans like Bio, because it gives them map control and it gives them freedom to do stuff generically, even though they might be able to do almost the same things with other styles, or they still have plays that they can make with other styles, but they feel easier when you have map control.
Yeah, I can see that.
So, Teo likes having map control and doesn't like playing passively.
I agree with that.
One of the interesting things about the very notion of map control is, typically speaking, the best strategy games... All good strategy games tend to feature a playing field in which taking control of the field is advantageous to do for you. Chess, for example, developing your pieces so that you can control more of the board is pretty much the most important thing you can do at the early game. You want to develop your pieces and try to limit your opponent's options. And in StarCraft, taking map control is also important specifically because of the fog of war. If your opponent doesn't have vision of what you're doing, limiting his vision by denying him the ability to move out of the map keeps him in the dark, makes him very defensive, very scared, and allows you to do things that might otherwise be suboptimal because your opponent will have a lot more difficulty knowing you're doing them.
Yeah, I think I always think about like the comparison of StarCraft 2 is kind of like chess mixed with poker. And so you like map control plays that dual role of not only does it like prevent your opponent from actually doing moves because, you know, they can't physically move out of their base or whatever, or can't move to a certain part of the map. But also it kind of limits them in that they have to prepare for certain things because they don't know what's going on. So they have to, they're limited in their options because they have to prepare for so many other things.
Yeah, it's like having position in poker. And by position, if anyone doesn't play poker, is when you act after someone, you're in a better position. You are you have an advantage because you can react to what they do. Or when you're the aggressor in poker, it's kind of similar, where if you're showing a strong hand, the other guy is naturally scared of whatever you may have, even though you may have a completely bad hand or whatever. So that's, I guess, the poker equivalent of map control is just being in a, either being in position or being the aggressor. I didn't explain that very well, but if you play, if anyone plays poker, you probably get it. If you don't play poker, you probably don't. My bad. Yeah, basically, if you act after someone in poker, you always have the advantage because when you're acting after someone, say you have a good hand and he bets, you can always raise him and put him in a bad position. Whereas if you're acting first, you don't know what the guy after you is capable of doing, so you're more, I guess, scared. And it's the same in StarCraft. If someone is in your face and you're turtling on your side of the map, you're more scared than when you're actually on the other side of the map doing whatever you want, even though maybe you only have 10 stalkers and you're taking a third instead of 20 stalkers and 7 gates behind it. That's what I was trying to say. I hope I explained it better this time.
I think it makes sense.
Yay.
Basically.
All right. Yeah. Jeremy, got anything to add?
No, I think you guys said it pretty well. Like, everything I did want to say, you guys just mentioned.
Especially the poker references?
Not the poker references, but kind of the chess references and just the, that whole thing in general.
Okay. So, why don't we talk about the concept of taking map control, how one goes about doing that.
Each race has their own way of taking map control, and each race can only take map control at certain times, right? So let's say Zerg, for example, against Terran. They'll always be able to have map control early game until, you know, the first four Hellions come out, and then map control will switch over to the Terran player for quite a while until, you know, the Zerg starts getting its creep out and the Mutas come out. There's, like, I feel like there's stages throughout the game in each matchup that each race will retake map control and then eventually lose it again until either, you know, a drop happens or an all-in happens or, you know, something along the lines of that.
So let's focus on that notion of timing you mentioned and asymmetric game design. So different tools, since each race in the game or in any game which features an asymmetric design has different tools and different options and different units, they're going to necessarily at different times be better or worse than their opponent at taking map control. So you mentioned two different units, Zerglings and Hellions there. Hellions are excellent map control units in the early game because they're very fast, which is why Zerglings can take them very early. When your units are faster than your opponent's, you can get to a position faster than your opponent can get there, which limits their ability to leave, because if they go too far away, you can beat them back to a point they need to protect or defend. In addition, Hellions are really strong against Zerglings until, like, they're massively outnumbered, especially if Zergling's speed isn't done. So, I mean, there's not really much the Zerg can do to kill the Hellions. And he can't leave his base because if he does, your Hellions can run in and start roasting drones. That is to say, they're fast. Then there's the other type of unit of map control, which is the really long-range siege unit that's just a powerhouse, like the siege tank. While you need a specific kind of map feature for them to really work well, and I'm sure we'll talk about that later, you can just stick a siege tank at a choke, and just it'll just lock down the area pretty well until they come with an overwhelming force.
One more thing that you were mentioning about fast units is fast units also allow you to outmicro your opponent, and that gives you map control. For example, Stalker against Marines. Because Stalkers are slightly faster than Marines and they have a little extra range, that's what gives, in certain situations, map control to Protoss early on, even though maybe the Marines are a little stronger in a straight-up fight. So that's also important. It plays, for example, in ZvZ when one guy gets Zergling speed and gets map control, and the other guy goes gasless and doesn't get map control. So speed is important for that. Not just getting to a position, but also just punishing anyone who overextends.
Cool. So yeah, the units, you know, you can fight what your opponent's got with them out in the field, even if they would lose in a straight up, you know, A move on A move fight. The speed of it allows you to, you know, retreat faster than your opponent. So if you're caught out in the map by a force you weren't expecting, you can still get out of there without losing the units if you're paying attention. You can backstab, which is, you know, what Blinkstalkers do, what Hellions do if they try to, like, come out with a quick early roach push and just march across the map. You can sneak your Hellions in behind to threaten drones. The fact that certain units are very good at taking map control. But the timing matters quite a bit too, as Jared mentioned before. If I make a whole bunch of Hellions 25 minutes into the game and try to take map control with it against Zerg, it's not going to work very well. He has the tools. He needs to just run them down and kill them, and they aren't going to do anything.
Yeah, I kind of think of it like, you know, now pulling from like League of Legends now, like I think of everything kind of in power spikes. And so, you know, for instance, when you have a ZVT type of thing, like once you get those Hellions, like you have this power spike that allows you to take control of the map, things like that. And then as soon as Zerg has something that's like really solid to deal with those Hellions, like roaches, or just like even a lockdown on their bases, they suddenly have a lot more room to move around on the map because they suddenly hit that power spike. And they have more power.
A power spike is the definition of a timing in SC2.
Yeah, I guess that's true. So,
yeah. Good point.
It's just different language, yeah. There are match-specific ones in which, you know, timings are different for Terran in Terran versus Protoss than they are in Terran versus Zerg. Even if you're doing, you know, basically the same strategy, they'll still be different because your opponent's weak timings are different. You know, you have units that can take map control at specific times, and that's very useful. And sometimes they can't, so you have to, you know, adjust for that ahead of time and plan for it. There's also the notion, I want to go back to something Jeremy talked about earlier, ground control versus air control. Hellions are a ground-to-ground unit. They can only shoot ground units at all. But they can still take a small amount of air control if they're up against the right type of strategy. Because by threatening a run-by into the opponent base, he has to have a certain amount of firepower at home to stop that from happening. And if he invests in air units too soon without having the proper ground control and tries to leave his base with it, you can just run in with the Hellions and he won't have anything to stop it. So if he, you know, does a 1-1-1 in TVT for some reason, it's not really something people do, but just imagine it hypothetically. He does a 1-1-1 and rushes out of Viking to deal with the Banshee. This used to happen. Not really something that happens anymore. And you run in with a bunch of Hellions. He had to keep his Viking at home, because if he sent it out on the map to try to hunt down a Vaam, any potential Banshees that might be coming or stuck it into your base to drop in your mineral line, suddenly he can't kill the Hellions that are running into his base roasting his SCVs.
Go ahead. One more thing on the timings. It's also a function of the metagame itself. For example, if you told a Terran in 2010... that a Protoss could have 7 Blinkstalkers outside of his base, or 10 Blinkstalkers, at 9 or 10 minutes, he would have just said, okay, that guy's shit, I'm gonna go kill him. Because back then, people just didn't do Blinkstalker builds like that. Now it's completely different, because you have the threat of Blink Hellions, because Protoss are better and whatnot. So it's the ability to take map control with a specific strategy is also a function of the metagame.
Metagame is very dependent on maps, though, not just player skill, map design.
It's not just maps, but strategy too. Three-base Blink in PvZ, for example, developed because Protoss needed to take map control against the Swarm Host builds, among other things. But that was one of the big things that made it become so popular. With most macro builds in PvZ, you always had this feeling of, I have to sit back until I have 160, 170 supply of things. And that just doesn't work very well in Heart of the Swarm. It did in Wings, not in Swarm anymore. So you had to develop something else. But that's because of the specific Zerg metagame.
Yeah. All right, so I want to, now that you brought that up, I want to talk a little bit about a specific strategic notion. That I like to call the burden of aggression. There was an article I read on the internet a long time ago that talked about this with relation to Magic the Gathering. I can't remember. I think the name of the article was The Beatdown or something like that, but I can't remember specifically. But it laid out the notion reasonably well if you've played that game. And the basic idea is that at certain times, you are required to be the aggressor, and depending on the tool set you have available and the tools your opponent has, and certain times you are required to be the defender. And if you choose to not do what you're required to do, you are handing your opponent an enormous advantage that should probably cost you the game. A notion of this is, for example, in with regard to as this relates to map control, I should say, if your opponent has map control and you just walk out of the map willy-nilly anyway, you deserve to probably lose. And it is on your opponent to execute and punish you properly. But if your opponent has control of the map and you ignore his control of the map, he's probably going to kill you. And in that sense, you have a burden to be passive, and he has a burden to be aggressive. You can't. Sometimes, as this relates, I should say, to map control, sometimes you have a burden to take map control. And sometimes you have a burden to cede it. Even though you can choose to sometimes fight over it, and sometimes it's iffy, your opponent will oftentimes at certain timings have tools that are simply better for taking it than you do. And you just have to sacrifice it or be willing to significantly outplay your opponent for an advantage that you probably shouldn't have at the time.
Yeah, that kind of
And in
makes
that
me
sense,
think of.
it's. This.
Go
Can I go first?
ahead. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, this reminds me of how Hero plays, Liquid Hero plays PvT all the time. In that he will randomly attack with like one Colossus in a range with two Forges behind it for no good reason. And this is an example of just doing something suboptimal that should get him killed. And when the other guy plays perfectly, he dies a horrible, painful death. But when the other guy fucks up, sometimes he wins and Artorias just freaks out. I remember some game on Antigua Shipyard when just this thing happened. And Artosis was like, okay, this is the best thing ever. Not that hero, Chris, the other hero,
Oh,
Liquid
okay.
Hero.
Oh, okay.
And I'm not
Liquid
saying
Hero is the boss, then.
what he does is good because
Poor CJ
it's not
Hero.
consistent.
He keeps winning and you
Yeah,
still
Chris,
don't
I
like
didn't
him.
even. Yeah.
I will never like CJ
Anyway.
Hero, sorry.
So in that specific situation for Liquid Hero, which I said, he
Ahead.
shouldn't be able to take map control, but because the and he should get punished for it. But if he can straight up brutally outplay his opponent, which he believes he can do, then he just may insta win the game or put the Terran in a bad spot because the Terran might be thinking, I want to do my medevac timing. And then he finds a Protoss running into him when the Protoss isn't supposed to run into him.
Right.
And
I'm kind of
yeah.
thinking of like a mech situation. Like, if we play that concept to mech, you have a lot of like the Avila type mechs out there who just kind of just sit back forever and don't do anything. And what they
Hello,
do.
Avilo. Hello.
Hello. And basically, it takes away all the advantages they might have because they have no map control at all. And it allows their opponent to completely out-expand them and just beat them with superior resources. So in that case, you have kind of the burden of like having to find an aggressive play with Hellbat drops and things like that in order to keep your opponent busy and keep them from getting so far ahead of you that you can't stop them, even though you have like the most cost-efficient army in the game.
Yeah, with regards to the Avilo, super ridiculously passive, I'm gonna max out on, this unit composition that's very, very expensive, like heavy Ravens, etc. That's a very suboptimal strategy for a number of reasons, most of which are do not pertain to today's discussion. But with regards to the map control specifics of it, it's very suboptimal because you are ceding map control at times when you could be taking it to limit your opponent's options. And one of the discussions we're going to get into here in a minute is how what effect map control has on the economy in the game. And as this relates to that, if you're giving your opponent map control when you have the option of taking it easily, and you are pretty much guaranteed to take it if you employ a strategy which does anything to take it, you are handing your opponent advantages that he doesn't deserve and shouldn't have. And that puts you in a much more difficult position than you should be. That's pretty much all there is to that. Your map control limits your options if your opponent has it. It gives him more options. It makes playing defensively even more difficult because, well, let's face it, if you've got a siege tank army outside your opponent's base sitting there with a bunch of Vikings and he can't leave his own base by ground, then how is he gonna walk his army into your base to attack you? So this will relate back to a vision discussion we're going to have a little bit later as well. So does anyone else have anything to?
That's the answer, Doom Drops.
Yeah.
I mean, you can try a Doom Drop, but if he's got – but one of the nice things – I guess we can get into the vision discussion now. One of the nice things about having map control is that you control the vision on the map. If your opponent doesn't have any units out of the map, or you know you sent a you know you're playing a TVZ, you send a Viking out to kill all the overlords, etc. He can't have any vision until he takes map control from you, because he has to force your army off the map before he can move units out to see anything. So if he has no vision and is trying drops, he's being exceedingly risky, and he's basically just crossing his fingers, hoping you don't see it coming. And of course, if you are taking true air control as well as just ground control, you're going to have vision at all the air routes, and you're going to have, you know, some type of force ready to intercept anything that moves out. So that just, frankly, if you're playing well when you have map control, that shouldn't work.
True.
It does sometimes because people make mistakes. No, you know, players aren't perfect, but it shouldn't strategically work.
Well, I mean, also, like, StarCraft is, like, I mean, maps are so big that, like, you can't possibly hope to have vision in everywhere. Like, I mean, you should be able to tell most things, but...
Unless you're Zerg.
Unless you're Zerg, and then you have free map packs.
Well, you know, do you remember, I'm trying to remember which Protoss it was. I can't remember which Protoss it was, but I remember seeing a game in which it was a PvT, and the Protoss kept making observers the whole game, and Terran just kept killing them.
That was Pig Baby, wasn't it?
It was, might have been Pig. Yeah, well, I think it was Pig Baby.
That was Tasia versus Rain on Whirlwind.
Okay, there were a bunch of games like there were several games like that. Yes, that one was one too.
I remember.
And he
that
just
game,
he just never stopped making observers. He wanted them all over the map. He wanted to spot every single route. And the observer in StarCraft is a very unique unit because it allows you to take vision without having map control. But it's different in the sense that it also doesn't deny your opponent vision to do it. And that's it's a tool Protoss needs, because Protoss is the race in StarCraft 2 that is least capable of taking map control. There are more times when Protoss cannot take map control than there are times where they are in any matchup.
I have to agree to that, actually. They kind of got shafted. But the Observer is a very
The Observer allows Protoss to compensate for that weakness quite a bit by allowing them to have vision anyway. And because they're much harder to hunt down and to kill. Unless, of course, you're running into players who build Ravens and then send Viking Raven hit squads around the map hunting down observers.
If you've ever
played against that as Protoss player, that is the most obnoxious thing you can run into.
Especially with fucking Colossus builds, when eventually you can't make observers. I hate that.
Yeah.
I guess
used to add a second robo just for observers.
Nice. Yeah, as Protoss, when you have like four observers and you're making Colossus and then the guy kills a couple of them, it just feels terrible.
Yeah, they're not free either.
I don't care about the cost. I'll make more zealots and aim move more, but I want to see things without seeing things.
Would you say that it's always worth it? Would you say it's always worth it for like Terran if they see like an observer, just like skin the hell out of it and chase it? Like, use, like, three scans, always. Kill it.
Three might not overkill two of them, yes.
One scan is absolutely worth it for an observer, so I just say be a little bit careful in the execution and make sure you get the kill.
Right.
Two is pushing it for a scan, and until later on in the game, in which you have so much energy you can't use it because you don't have enough mineral fields to just keep muling nonstop, but...
I think the second scan is worth it because it's going to piss off the Protoss.
He's gonna twit them on tilt. That's why it's worth it.
Yeah.
Psychological warfare.
Yeah.
Don't teach Jer these things.
That's how
guys are right here.
He's here taking notes. Like, time to get revenge. As a Terran player, it's absolutely worth it to spend a scan to kill an observer, but. The notion of vision is, in map control, barring the observer, because that's the unique exception in StarCraft. If you have map control, your opponent can't see anything. As long as you're, you know, properly hunting down anything that goes out. If you can just put a spread... Picture a situation in which a Terran player has a Protoss. Let me go with a better example. A Zerg has a Terran player contained. He's done something. He's got the Terran contained. Maybe the Terran's doing a mech build, just took his third base. He set up with the siege tanks. He can't push out immediately. And Zerg just has a ring of overlords surrounding the base. And Zerg's got control of the map. What is Terran going to do that Zerg isn't going to see coming? And the fact that he has complete control of the map means he has very much less vision space that he needs to be able to control. Because the area right outside your opponent's base is much smaller than the entire horizontal, the entire line directly across from corner to corner across the map, or horizontal all the way across the middle of the map, or so on and so forth. And of course, the Terran player in this example, he can't see anything except with scans, so he has to pretty much just guess and hope if he's going to try that route.
I think so the best specific example of something like that that I can think of was Tejas TVT in like 2012 when he played in Daybreak. I didn't remember seeing him ever lose on Daybreak because he would just have a... You know how you have the three lanes going through the center of the map? He would just have tank lines on all three of them. He always went mech. And then the other guy just couldn't go or do anywhere because Teja always just had map control, and then he sat there and he won eventually because he had two-thirds of the map for himself, basically.
Well, it helped at the time that Teja was the only one who was good at playing back at the pro level. No one else had bothered to learn any of it yet, and everyone was trying to go bio against him on a map where you can't go bio against mech.
There's a difference between being the only one that can go mech and being completely undefeated. I don't remember seeing him ever lose Daybreak as Terran.
Well, that particular map was ridiculous. That particular map was so strong for a properly executed mech build that anyone who wasn't going mech against a mech player should lose if the mech player knew what he was doing.
Yeah, but he did that even in mech mirrors. Like, in mech mirrors, he always just had used the map better. He knew exactly where to be. Yeah, but, you know, it's Deja. But what I'm saying is, he used map control specifically to be better than his opponents. He had just that little extra on the map. Because he had, you know, how you have the final two bases that you take when the rest of Daybreak is mined out. He would be able to take those just much more consistently than anyone else because he could control the map better. And that's what's winning a lot of games.
Let's have a brief Terran discussion then.
I can do that.
I've been playing Terran a bit lately as random. Let's talk a little bit about specifically relies on map control with their differing strategies. So mech is obviously very reliant on map control because you either completely seed it by turtling in your base or you have to push to very specific map locations to siege up to cover that specific areas to limit your opponent's mobility and movement because your units are so exceedingly small. But that differs quite a bit from how bio plays out because bio still takes map control frequently in a lot of matchups. But it does it in a very different fashion. So, Jared, do you want to talk about that a bit?
All right. So, yeah, when you bio, you basically, you know, you get your medivacs. The boost edition for Hearthstorm really helped that a lot because, yeah.
Let's buff medivacs some more, Blizzard.
Yeah. But anyways, so you basically have to wait for your medivacs to come out. So then when you get your medivacs as bio, then you can start setting clusters of units everywhere on the map. And as soon as you see any counter-aggression, you just pick up your units and boost out and then kind of push somewhere else with bio. So then that forces your opponent to consistently stay in their end of the map, defending all these different locations. So essentially that just gives you a free rally point with your bio units and your medivacs into the middle of the map, and then you can do whatever you want with them. Contrast that to mech. Mech are slow units. You know, you got the tanks, the Thors, the Vikings, everything is so slow for them. You do have the Hellions, which is a good tool to, you know, counterattack and stuff, but it's much harder in general for mech players to get map control. So you see them turtle up, wait for that critical mass of siege tanks and you know, a couple of Thors sometimes, but get the Vikings out and everything. You see a lot of the time the meching player gets sensor towers to kind of counteract their no map control, right? So sensor towers are a very good way of giving them some sense of control, right, on the map. So they'll be risking drops, right? So they'll send out, you know, Hellbat drops on the map. Well, I'll talk TVT specifically here. So they'll do a lot of Hellbat drops without having any kind of vision at all on the map. So that's kind of taking a little risk. You know, I mean, it's not too bad because normally the bio player won't have a big Viking count or something. And maybe they won't have a lot of turrets back at their base. So they'll be sending out drops. They'll be just waiting for that critical mass of mech units to push out on the map. So when their map control comes into play is when they've successfully defended the bio drops and pushes out, and then when they get that critical mass, they can finally push out and take the Zelnaga towers. They can you know, have their sensor towers up, get their fourth base, and then they can make one big push to the bio player, and then hopefully kill them with that one big push, because it's very hard to engage a max out mech army's bio, but that's a different discussion. So yeah, for TVT, it's basically, throughout the whole game, the bio player will have very, very good map control, and then at the end game, basically, is where the mech player can finally retake the map control. That's pretty much TVT in a nutshell for bio versus mech.
I guess the difference is, as Joel was saying, there are two different kinds of map control, because bio can be anywhere on the map at any moment they want, basically, whereas mech can be like, I like this spot on the map, and then they always control that spot. So if they can find a key spot on the map to control, that puts them in a very good position.
Yeah, so these key spots will normally be, you know, while they're defending, it'll be somewhere in between their three bases that they can easily get back to another part of the base if they need to. And then once they go on the offense, they want to get, you know, right in between the enemy Terran's bases. So they control that whole area and make it very hard for the enemy Terran bio player to engage the mech army.
This this notion of positional control, I don't want to get too much into this because it's kind of off topic, but just a brief snippet. Notion of specific control of specific locations with mech, whereas bio doesn't really need to control specific places as badly as mech does to work out, is one of the big reasons why mech and bio will never really be properly balanced against each other on every map, because they can't be. Some maps have features that favor mech heavily compared to bio, and other maps have the opposite, by virtue of lacking mech-focused features. So a lot of people, for a very long time in Wings of Liberty and Heart of the Swarm, complained that mech wasn't viable. But it wasn't really so much that mech wasn't viable as it was, because it based as it was that most maps didn't favor mech. We didn't really have a lot of map features that were particularly good for it. And bio works on any map in the other matchups. I mean, there's never really much of a map against Terran or against Zerg or Protoss where you want to say, you know what, bio can't work here. So for that reason, because people, rather than learning multiple strategies and for each individual map, people just kind of stuck with bio. But anyway, I don't really want to get too much into that for now. Just an example of the topic that we're about to get into, which is how the notion of map control shapes unit design and race design for timings, tech levels, etc., etc.
One thing, I'll go get a drink. Be right back.
All right. Okay. So when you're designing an asymmetrical game, every race needs to have different tools, so things need to be taken at different times, and so on and so forth. But certain units are so much better at taking map control than other units at certain times that you need to limit the tech level at which those units are available in some way, shape, or form to either to make it a significant investment in order to accomplish that, or you need to – or to say basically that go ahead and just do this with this unit, but we'll weaken the unit so it doesn't scale as well, or any number of other things. And we're going to do an episode on unit design, which we'll get more into this later. But for right now, I want to focus on another Terran unit, the Cyclone, and how it can take map control very easily. Mm-hmm. So, Jeremy, as the resident Terran, would you like to discuss the Cyclone?
All right. I think they changed it since the last time I played Legacy. I really haven't been playing any Legacy at all. It still has a lock-on ability, right?
Yes. They just the recent match patch notes, if I recall correctly. They're fixing that with the latest notes I've read from Blizzard. They're giving it back its anti-air attack, but it's going to be significantly lower damage than it used to be. It's getting two attacks now. It has an attack that does lower damage than it used to against ground units. And another attack that targets air units that does even less damage than that. And then later on, you can get an upgrade that upgrades the damage to both from both of them, so that the air damage is still lower than it was originally with its initial design, but the anti-ground damage will actually be better than it was used to be.
Sounds really, upgrade. Really complicated and complex for one unit.
It is a very complicated unit to make work properly, but let's... why don't we discuss how it against Protoss, how it takes map control?
I used to like it a lot against Protoss, but then I played Huck, and then he just made a Phoenix. He made Phoenix openings and like just wrecked my Cyclones.
But that is actually
Phoenix, when they don't Phoenix, it's very easy to say the least, to take map control throughout the whole game against Protoss, because the automatic lock-on ability just destroys everything, and it's, I don't think it was really fair for Protoss.
Fairness aside, I don't really want to get too much into the balance of it, but when we saw the Cyclone design, didn't I say that Protoss is going to have to go Phoenix Openers against it?
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah,
I called it.
If they don't make Cyclones, then they're kind of screwed anyways.
Yeah, that's a problem.
It's a really nice map control, because as soon as you get one out, then you can just send it literally to their base, and as long as you keep somewhat of an eye on your Cyclone, that way you don't lose it, and just continuously try to pick off unit after unit, the Protoss won't be able to get anything out on the map. They won't be able to get any vision on the map, minus the Observer, because that's cloaked. And the Terran are basically free to do whatever they want, because they'll be able to see when the Protoss is pushing out, they can react to it with bunkers or different units accordingly. Yeah, it's the Cyclone provided that. It was a very good tool for Terran users against Protoss.
Yeah, so the specific traits of the unit that make it so good for that is the fact that it's A, extremely fast in the early game. B, its damage output is very high. Its damage per second is extremely high, so it a single Cyclone can deal with a much larger number of units than just one. So even though its tech level is kind of difficult to get out, you only really need to field one or two to secure map control. It can shoot air units, so, I mean, they can't even rush an air unit like a Mothership Core and then just, like, try to chase it away with that, because it'll kill it. The lock-on isn't actually necessary for it to take map control, because with proper executed micro, it wouldn't make a difference. The lock-on mechanic is just effectively a way of reducing the Cyclone's range for the initial engagement, and then allowing its range to increase after the fight starts. But it's if you imagine the Cyclone just having a longer range than just the initial and getting rid of the lockdown, it doesn't really change how the unit would be used other than the micro requirement of having to actually kite.
Can I talk about why I don't like the Cyclone as a map control unit?
Well, you don't like using it, or you don't like the design?
I don't like the design of it as a map control unit.
Go ahead.
The main reason for that is... first of all, I think it overlaps way too much with Hellion, because Hellions have pretty much the same like time period that they're used to gain map control. I mean, I guess like Cyclones are, like if we think about like TVZ, Cyclones are better against Queens and Roaches, but not quite as good against like Masslings or something like that. But they still kind of overlap in the same time period. And there's also this issue of, like, especially when you think about TVP, where Jeremy says, like, as soon as you get a Cyclone, like, you have map control for the rest of the game, because it's taking over that period where Protoss used to have somewhat of an advantage, because they could move out on the map with Stalkers and things like that to gain map control early. And then Stim and Medrax would come in, and Terran would be able to push that map control back. But now it's kind of like you get a Cyclone and you have map control up until like, 8, 9, 10 minutes, and then you have Medivacs and Stim, and you have map control for like another 5, 6 minutes.
Okay. You make a good point with that, but Cyclones, I want to point out, only take ground control now. Even though they can shoot air, they can only be in so many places at once on the map, and they can't, by the time a Cyclone's out, you don't have the ability to have vision all over the map yet. So you can easily like rush an Oracle out and just get past it and go into their base with it or something. You can do a Warp Prism drop with Immortals or any number of other things. So they're not as bad as they were, in a way, but the balance issues aside, the Cyclone is an example of we'll get into unit design, on our next episode actually, which is about unit design, but, with regard to map control, the Cyclone is entirely a map control unit. It's not good at anything other than map control, except in the mirror.
I don't know. I think they used to kill like just straight up units pretty well.
Well, that was because their numbers were just tweaked too high for their cost. Like the Warhounds were in the Heart of the Swarm beta. The numbers were just tweaked too high on the Cyclone. There's nothing about the design the unit design itself that suggests it should be good at just straight up fighting.
Yeah,
it's just that the numbers were a little too high. But design-wise, it's just a fast unit that has really long range and really high damage.
It also has a lot of health too, like 195 or 200 or something. It's pretty tanky.
So it's a Warhound. Yeah, no, the thing about Cyclones, regarding Protoss specifically, I can see why they were added, because what happened between Wings and Heart of the Swarm with Overcharge is people say that Terran actually lost any ability to do anything against Protoss in the early game. That's wrong. They only lost the ability to attack straight up into the Protoss natural with things like Turaks or, you know, stim timings without medivacs, whatever. They can still harass pretty well with all their like mind drops and medivac drops, which are actually standard now. Like, it's standard for Terran to pressure Protoss, in fact. But, so they can kind of have air control, but the map control side of things is completely gone for Terran. So I can see why they would try to add that. They would add a unit that can actually just show up at the Protoss natural exclusively and fuck things up if the Protoss isn't ready for it. Like, for example, Turaks used to be able to do in Wings of Liberty. And by Turaks, I mean Turaks with Marauders and Marines.
And it's interesting to note that the Cyclone can't be really used against Zerg in the same way.
Yeah. But the thing is, I don't know that it's enough for a unit to just have that little thing going for it. So the anti-air, of course, helped the Cyclone just being the best defensive unit Terran could possibly have. Usually only talk about Protoss matchups because they're the ones I understand best. So for Legacy and with Cyclones also having anti-air, what happened was they gave Terran all the map control they wanted in the early game, and they also made it so Terran was almost invulnerable to anything because they could chase down an Oracle, they could chase down a War Prism with Disruptors in it, whatever you wanted to do.
Right.
So it's, I don't know, and when you take that away, which they did, it feels to me like it's in a really weird spot where it's a ridiculously situational unit, which is fine. But, I don't know, I'm not entirely convinced it's the greatest idea, I guess.
Okay.
I mean, it's a thing. But it can be a thing, but...
Right, we'll focus more on the Cyclone in our next episode where we actually discuss the unit design as our main topic. But I don't want to get too bogged down on this. But, we've discussed how the Cyclone functions right now. What would change if you made a Cyclone require a fusion core before it was built? Hypothetically. If you didn't change any stats on the Cyclone whatsoever, nothing changed on the Cyclone, but it required a fusion core to be built, it would be completely useless, right?
Yeah.
Maybe you'd make it super late game if it's already being made super late game for some reason, but
I think you'd ever see the Cyclone again.
Right. So... This notion of map control. Right, so this notion of map control heavily affects tech levels and timings because for game design, units need to be designed to come out at a time where they will be useful, or else the unit design needs to be changed entirely, which we'll get into next. So with regards to map control, a unit designed for map control needs to be early game, hands down, because before the economy gets out of hand to the point where you can make a lot of them very quickly. Because if a unit is designed on its own to excel at securing map control a little bit later in the game, then they become massable because of the way the economy develops.
Yeah, I think that's more or less correct.
And when a unit is massable and on its own secures map control, you wind up with a significant problem where no one can ever leave their base against this Racy ever again.
If we go back to the other example you had, where you have kind of the map control, like the more static map control, like Siege Tanks or whatever, which allows you to take position on the map, not necessarily like in an aggressive way, but in kind of a defensive way, move forward and expand your area a little bit more. Does that make sense?
Yep. The notion we differentiated before between fast units and siege units for map control purposes.
Right.
Siege units are okay to be massable a little bit later, because they have very clearly defined weaknesses that can allow the opponent to deal with that. And so they can come out a little bit later and be massable. And the other thing is that they take map control of a specific location, but they don't take control of the entire map on their own unless they're right outside the opponent's base, like at a very specific choke, because they're just not fast enough to be everywhere. I mean, imagine for a second if the Colossus could shoot up. What would wind up happening with that? It would just, you just mass pure Colossus. You just make only Colossus fair. And you'd walk. Yeah, it'd be very fair. So with regards to the tech levels, units need to be, if they're designed for map control, they need to be specifically early game, or else they can't have their only function as a design be map control. So I think that's enough on unit design until next episode. Does anyone have anything else to add on that before we move on?
No, I think that's pretty much covers it.
Yeah.
Well, I could give one example. So another thing that I'm thinking about in terms of taking map control and tech levels is I think back to the Heart of the Swarm beta with the Tempest, back when you could just get it off of a naked Stargate.
that was fun.
And it allowed a lot of people to, and it also had 22 range. Like, it could shoot like twice the range of a siege tank. It was awesome. But it allowed you basically to get like this really early siege unit that would give you basically like another like screen or two of map control outside of your base, and you could use that to aggressively take bases and things like that until they moved it up to the help me out here Fleet Beacon. Yep. There we go.
Yep.
I was like, it's an F word, but I don't remember which one.
That's what you get for playing League of Legends.
So disappointed. Yeah, I'm so disappointed.
But they moved it up to the Fleet Beacon, and suddenly it was like no longer good for that.
Well, do you remember in Legacy the Void Alpha when they were actually considering, for a while there, making it not require the Fleet Beacon, and then having it be as fast as a Mutalisk, but not being able to shoot up anymore?
What? No, I missed that part.
Yeah, I remember that.
The Tempest was range 15 Mutalisk that couldn't shoot up. Which I'm just like, what is this?
It's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard.
It didn't last very long. But it did not last long. But
the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard was the 4 movement speed DTs. That would have been gorgeous.
That was also completely fair. Yes.
Okay. I would have been so unbelievably happy with 4 movement speed DTs. You have no... And you've seen me play, so you should understand. You have a basic idea of what happens when I play Protoss.
Alright, back on topic.
back on topic for a minute here. So, why don't we have a brief segment on map features?
Okay. So, like Zelnaga Towers and stuff like that?
Yeah, so we actually had a question on Twitter about Zelnaga Towers and what we thought about them. So why don't we go around and everybody share your opinion?
All right, Zelnaga Towers. I like the idea of it as long as it doesn't give away too much of the vision, right? Like, they can't show... Like, here's a good example. I feel on Overgrowth, if you have both towers and then you position a unit to the left of the left one and then one to the right, you can see the entire horizontal line of the map with just control of both watchtowers and then one extra unit on either side. So you can see literally anything coming through. I think that was a little too much vision, you know?
Mm-hmm. Chris?
So my favorite map in all of StarCraft II is Neoplanet S.
Here we go.
Oh, God.
I mean, even though, I understand that there were a lot of imbalances and stuff like that, but what made Neoplanet S, like, so interesting to me was just the fact that it was, as far as I know, it was the first StarCraft II map to not feature Zelnaga Towers. And it was just really cool. Like, I remember Flesh versus Life in, like, the beta preview. I think it was when they debuted the game. And they had, like, a mini tournament, Flash 1. But, like, they played on that map, and it was so cool to watch Flash. Like, he would just make individual middle Widow Mines and just, like, move them to different parts of the map to burrow. And that would, like, give him a little bit of vision and also, like, some map control in those areas. And I thought that was so cool because we hadn't seen that before, because everything was like, you just send a unit to the watchtower and you're like, oh, his entire army's running this way. I think I'm good.
Reminds me of when I used to play Protoss at the time. I would just man train all in every game, and I had 100% win rate
yes.
on that map doing that. But,
I would man train PVZ and proxy Oracle into Furgate PVT, and I was undefeated.
Yeah, I really don't like that map as CERN. At all.
It was pretty good. It was a terrible map in balances, yes. but it was a lot of fun to just man train every game. But that aside,
yes.
Teo, your opinion on watchtowers?
I think the idea works, but you have to be very careful as far as the specific map design. As Jeremy said, you can have towers that are too good, or you can be in a situation like on Kula's Ravine, if anyone remembers that map, which is basically a gigantic Zelnaga tower. There's like 20 of them on it or something ridiculously stupid like that. If you look it up on Liquipedia, you'll see it's basically only Zelnaga towers. So you have to be careful about how you implement that. And yeah, even Blizzard is aware of it. If you look at what's the map they're playing on now with the two gold bases in the center where MKP threw the match. Fuck.
I don't remember the exact name of the
that's
map.
That's the one
I know
the
back door,
right?
Yeah. Yeah, the backdoor one.
I can't remember.
Expedition Lost?
Was that Expedition Lost, is it? Yeah, that's
okay.
it.
Okay. Yeah, if you look at Expedition Lost, I think if that map had been made in 2011, they would actually have put the Zelnaga Towers overlooking the center of the map. But now they've kind of figured out that, or people kind of, I think, prefer if the towers don't cover absolutely everything. Which can kind of work in some situations, but it generally, I think it's a little too good.
Okay, so my opinion on Zelnaga towers is that they can work well, but it's very, very dependent on proper usage. It's because oftentimes they're more harmful than useful. And one of the things that differentiates a good map maker from a bad one is how well they use special features like that. But if you think about what a Zelnaga watchtower is it's a specific location on a map by which having control of it allows the units that control it to have a much wider vision range as long as they remain stationary. And that basically just means is that you can have more vision for a smaller investment if you have map control.
Mm-hmm.
Because you need map control to hold the Zelnaga Watchtower. Or at least control map control up to a Zelnaga Watchtower. And usually if you have up to the Watchtower, you have at least half the map or whatever, depending on where it's positioned. But and Teo mentioned the problem of putting them in the center of the map.
Sorry. The chat, somebody's like, they got on the topic of Cloud Kingdom, and someone says, is it bad that I never like Cloud Kingdom? Everyone immediately says yes.
Cloud Kingdom was great,
yes.
all the things. Because I mean, it's okay to not like certain maps. That's fine. You don't have to like every map that everybody else does. You're wrong for not liking it, but you don't have to like it. The notion of Zelnaga watchtowers can be a good thing if they're done well, but you don't want to. They should be used when you want to make either map control stronger on a map than it otherwise would be, by allowing you to invest a smaller amount of units to gaining the vision effect. So if you think about it in terms of an aggressive map control strategy, which is what I like to refer to as strategies that attack but then stop outside the opponent's base to pin them.
Yeah, okay.
So you want to get them stuck in their base. So that's an aggressive move that takes map control. If you want to hold the watchtowers, you need to either send workers out on the map to the watchtowers, or you need to pull units out of that aggressive position to them. Imagine if the watchtowers aren't there and you want to get a complete ring around your opponent's base of vision. You either need to send workers out to build buildings that aren't going to last very long once you lose map control, or you need to spread your forces out in order to get vision of all routes. So in that sense, Zelnaga towers allow you to have a less investment into map control for the same effect. As if they weren't there. So they map control a stronger tactic and strategy. They can also be used not necessarily for map control, but for situations in which there are obscure pathways around the edge of the map that, for because of terrain reasons, would be too difficult to have vision of if you're not Zerg with overlords. So imagine you have a very big area at the edges of the map with tons of empty airspace and no ground unit can get there. And then right at the edge of that, you have a Zelnaga watchtower. You could send one unit there to get vision of the giant airspace so that drops could sneak around as easily. But if you don't have overlords, then you'd have to either send observers out to the corner of the map where they can't see anything except that one drop route. Or you would have to build actual air fighting units and just leave them there or something or so on and so forth. So in that sense, Zelnaga towers can be used sometimes not to benefit a map control tactic, but can be used to make something that would be excessively difficult, like defending those drop routes, a bit easier to compensate for map features being a little too good. But
that's Dashen Terminal, right? Like the bottom left on Dashen Terminal, there's a Zelnaga tower that can overlook all the bottom left area. So you can kind of protect yourself from that direction, but the general pushing direction is on through the center of the map, like further north, I guess.
Putting Zelnaga watchtowers in the center of the map can have its place on map where, on maps where you want to specifically make mech stronger or slow push strategy stronger, because having towers in the middle of the map in your pushing lane make strategies that are good at controlling small areas, but a lot stronger by giving you more time to react to movements around your forces, and more specifically by preventing your opponent from playing the Viking game. If you think about TVT, people used to play just siege tank Viking every game, and the Vikings would try to kill the enemy Vikings so that you'd have a vision advantage to your siege tank and shoot. But sitting on a watchtower, there's nothing that they can do because they're just going to have vision no matter what. So on and so forth. So. Watchtowers can have a lot of different uses, but they tend to be overused, I think, and that's my opinion.
Yeah, I agree.
I think they could be done a little better, but for the purposes of map control, I like the way that they function, but I would rather see larger packs of units, or even just like lots of splitting off of smaller groups of units to control the map, as opposed to having to send one unit and suddenly that side of the map you're like, okay, it's fine, everything's fine on that side of the map.
Yeah, but in some situations you can't do that, like as Protoss going Colossus, for example, you can't really split your army. As Terran going mech, you can't do that. As Zerg going Broodlords, it's kind of hard, although Zerg get map packs, so
for Protoss, you know, you can put out pylons and things like that to get vision. It works the same.
Yeah, but it's you can do that less consistently, I think, than just sending a zealot or a marine or whatever to a Zelnaga tower.
I don't want to get too much into the balance of it, just because each race has different tools, so each race should be better or worse at specific times of dealing with that. But
yeah, of course.
Watchtowers certainly have their place. I think they're a little overused. So other map features besides Zelnaga watchtowers? Cliffs are great for map control because they allow a unit that outranges other units to control space better. Think about a siege tank, right? You put three siege tanks on top of a cliff. It becomes much harder to attack those siege tanks and get anywhere near that place than if they were in the middle of just an empty field.
That ends up being way more situational, though.
Well, yes, but let's go back to 2010 for a second and discuss a little map called Lost Temple.
You can go back to 1998, where top Lost Temple could actually siege the gas on right or something like that.
That's because that was like absurdly huge.
Beautiful.
Quickly.
Yep. But remember that high ground cliff next to the natural? You could just stick siege tanks on there, and your opponent not only couldn't take their natural, but they couldn't leave their natural because the siege tanks would shell them just trying to walk out of their base. That's an example of somebody really overdoing the map features to benefit certain types of map control, but...
Can I just say, I love how Lost Temple has been in every Blizzard game since, I think, 1995 or close to that, and it's always been broken as fuck.
Great, though.
Every time.
No, the Frozen Throne Lost Temple wasn't that bad.
It was pretty bad.
It wasn't the worst. The original Lost Temple of Warcraft 3 was
it wasn't
broken.
As bad because you had to actually buy dropships. You couldn't make them yourself, but
yeah.
But that aside, other features. So imagine a perfectly flat map with no terrain features whatsoever, except for the actual mineral fields and Vespine geysers, right? Zerg has map control on this map 100% of the time.
Yeah, easily.
Yep.
So you got all the choke points as a map feature. That's really cool, too. That'll benefit tanks a lot. Yeah, you actually mentioned that a lot, really, too. Lots of narrow choke points.
I think
so like
basically...
Daybreak would be the perfect example for that, because there's just the three laneways, and then just, like, the Tasia example would be perfect for that kind of feature. Mm-hmm. Then you also have destructible rocks.
Right. I think, like, anything with, like, splash damage benefits from chokes. Like, anything that has that kind of mechanic to it.
Yeah, of course.
It's just, like, chokes are just, like, oh, the best.
But, yeah, just speaking about specific features on maps other than that, other than chokes, cliffs, Zelnaga towers, what else can we think of? Well,
what about the,
Total Biscuit...
the grass? The
yeah, tall grass. Line of sight blockers. They limit vision. They require you to. That's a counterexample to Zeldaga Towers, because they require you to have more units to have vision out on the map and invest more, because they reduce field of vision for the units that you have. Unless, of course, you invest air units to doing it.
Line of sight blockers are actually a good example of something that can offset map controls. So, for instance, you'll see Terrans hiding Marines in them, and then a Protoss walks up to it with the Stalker and he loses it, even though he shouldn't, or Zerglings hiding behind them to trap Hellions or whatever.
Yeah, one of the weirdest things about line of sight blockers is when somebody sticks a Zelnaga tower right next to line of sight block, like right near line of sight blockers.
Yes.
Yeah, like a Meridor Ram, like it's surrounded by the grass or whatever.
Well, I don't mean directly around it, because that's to defend the unit that's holding the watchtower and give them more time to run away if you need to. I mean more like when it's just like when there's like nearby, there's some terrain feature with the line of sight blockers, and there just happens to be a Zelnaga tower somewhere nearby that you can just see over the entire thing anyway.
Right.
Oh, like on Shakura's Plateau?
Yeah, like Shakura's Plateau.
That was really frustrating to get control of the Zelnaga tower on that map.
Yeah, I fucking hated that map, honestly.
I like the back door rocks, that was really
So there's also airspace, because it limits, because it gives more maneuverability to air units while taking away from ground units. It makes ground control strategies less effective, and makes air control strategies more important.
I think that's a really good example of like a good. I really like the vision, the grass and the fog, whatever they're called.
Line of sight blockers.
Line of sight blockers, yeah. I just like it as a design for the game a lot.
Would you prefer more line of sight blockers and less Zelnaga towers?
I wouldn't prefer more line of sight blockers. I think it's very good right now, the method used, but maybe a little bit less Zelnaga towers.
One of the interesting things is Mavis brings it up, unpathable space, but that's just another form of it's putting that in the ground area and not airspace to the outside allows ground units to still control the area while still limiting their mobility. So that's a different way to strengthen airplay while weakening ground play, but without completely limiting it as heavily. It's just putting a gigantic cliff that says no ground unit can go over here.
AKA the anti-blink mechanic.
Yeah, stuff like that. Yeah, the anti-blink.
that's like the, I feel like that's most of what unpathable space, like on terrain, is used for.
Yeah, the let's not make blink imbalanced on this map, please. Like Ohana. Ohana was I think the first map to do that.
It's
where
beautiful.
They were like, yeah, one more reason why it was a great map.
Well, that's because Cloud Kingdom was the Cloud Kingdom and what was it? What was the name of the something Shipyards? Antigua Shipyards.
Oh yeah, Antigua. Fuck
first,
that map. Fuck it.
For the first two maps where people were actually doing blink all ins.
That was a PBT nightmare unless you blink all in first.
Well, no, it was
that's
actually
why you
decent
blink
all in
it.
On Antigua. My PBT in Antigua was actually decent.
No, it was awful because they could pick up outside the natural and just go straight into the main, and like. then go keep going back and forth like that. And like Colossus were retarded because it was a double wall, so Colossus would have to walk all the way around.
See, that's why you went Templar instead.
That's true.
back when Templar opened it, because there was no Widow Mine, Templar opening still worked. At any rate, so that's most of the map talk we're going to cover today. Well, we're going to do another episode on maps at some point.
Can I just say, like, what about using bases as map control? So like,
okay, so that was a good point I had forgotten about that I had wanted to bring up.
Yeah. So like gold bases and like island bases and things like that, how do they affect map control?
So those are a form of objective on the map that don't grant any benefit except economy, which is fine. But the really cool thing about the notion of bases is that Terrans, when you play Terran, one of the first things you have to think about on the map and in the matchup you are is what attack path you want to use. What's going to be the pathing you choose and the army movement pattern you take into pressure, especially in TVZ where your pressure is almost constant. Especially if you're doing the old SC parade push style, which is my favorite way to play Terran. But you pick up an attack path and you want to expand along that path because you're going to control that path. You're not going to control the rest of the map because your army's not going to spread out. You're going to control a specific segment of the map, so you want to expand that way so that your theory you control protects your bases. Island bases are very, very risky because almost always island bases are off the beaten path and not along an expansion path that already exists or easily defensible. Mm-hmm. In the cases where they are easily defensible, such as they're right behind your main, like way station. Oh my god, I hate way station. that map was atrocious. The problem with that having them directly behind in that sense is that you're still the notion of an island base still gives more credence to the notion of taking air control while weakening ground control positions. Because if you can take an island base, you need air control to threaten that, and ground control doesn't help you protect it or aggress one. If someone has taken one. Mm-hmm. So when island bases are on a map, it makes airplay more important, ground play weaker. So that's a way to do that. I haven't seen a good example of island bases being used in StarCraft II yet in a way that I was extremely fond of. I've seen a couple of cases where they're okay, especially in some outbox of the TLMC maps that I liked. Yeah, outbox was okay. Excuse me. But the notion of an island base or a base just along your attack path is mm-hmm. just if you're playing an aggressive strategy and you're going to control a specific part of the map, make sure your bases are near that so you can defend them. If you try to expand someplace or chase objectives in areas that you cannot easily control, then it's going to make defending them and protecting them much more difficult.
Yeah. Back to your point of maps of bases defining your attack path. I think it's really interesting how on some maps people take specific bases depending on their strat. So like on Expedition Lost, Zergs will take one or even two golds and then they do some roach style. Or on a map like Belshire Vestige, Terran would take the other third and then have an easier push towards the Zerg. Things like that I think are really interesting and they kind of play into map control, as in the map control you get makes that base more defensible and just better, even though it's really counterintuitive. So it's a cool thing to see when people find those things out about maps and they figure the correct strategies to play.
It kind of reminds me of the forward base on Overgrowth. I remember when Overgrowth first came out, everyone saw that base and they were like, nobody's ever going to take this base. This base is like the shittiest place on Earth. But then like after a while, like people figured it out, especially Terrans, who were like, this is the greatest base in the world because I can, you know, just push straight through it.
Yeah, and then you just take the watchtower and you have a complete vision outside of that base too, and it's so easily defensible. Yeah.
Yeah.
The best example of Terran play I can think of doing that is back to Daybreak. If you were playing aggressive, you took the forward base towards the middle, and if you were playing defensive, you took the third base up to the north or south, depending on whether you were the right or the left side of the map.
Right.
The one above or below your natural, rather than the one forward to the middle. So you just picked whether you're going to be aggressive or defensive, and then you took the correct one to fit it. And it was, and you could always tell while watching the game if the player was going to be aggressive or not based on which third base they took. So that was it's just a that's a pretty simple good example, I think. So why don't we talk about the notion of, again, let's go back to seeding map control and when you should pursue it and when you shouldn't.
Yeah.
In other words, when is it a good thing for someone to take map control, and when is it a bad thing for them to take map control?
Well, it's a bad thing when you don't have a big army. You're going to die if you push out. So you have to come up with some other way to...
I would suggest that if you're going to die if you take map control, then you don't really have map control, right? Because map control isn't just the ability to take to move out on the map yourself. It's also the ability to prevent your opponent from moving out on the map.
I think like a good example that I can think of is like those classic moments where like Terran is like not quite, they don't have like vision of the Zerg base, and they're like not quite sure if they're getting like Roachbane busted, but like they think maybe they are, and they like they get busted like once, and then like okay, everything's fine, and then they start to move out on the map, and then like 50 more Banelings come rolling in, and they're like, what the hell is this?
Yeah, a good example of that recently actually is Dark versus Maru in the SPL finals. That's exactly what happened.
Yeah, but that's one of those issues where like where you don't have complete information, and so when you try to take map control, it ends up backfiring.
Okay, so that's an error with the notion of taking map control. Like, let's assume for a moment that the person actually succeeds in taking map control, that they don't misjudge the situation and they actually can take and do take map control. Yeah. When is that bad? Should you always just take map control if you can get it? Is it always the correct decision to take map control if you are capable of taking it?
I mean, you said yourself earlier that yes, that...
Yeah, like, I feel like, yeah, in every situation it is, unless...
If you can take it, yes, the issue is players judging correctly or not. Like, sometimes you feel like you can take map control, but you actually can't. For example, if you're Terran, and you're like, okay, time to move out with my medevac timing, and you run into a Colossus lane outside of your natural, that was a bad time to try to take map control, even though on paper it seemed like a good idea before you did it. So there can be situations... where you can get punished for it, but in general, if it is safe to do so, as in you're not going to die for trying, then yeah, you should.
So I'm actually going to surprise everyone by disagreeing, even though everyone's basing their agreement off of something
course.
I said earlier. All
right, go ahead.
Here we go.
So the cost in me, I got that, you know, the economy... sees a couple of other things that I need to bring up. The notion, first of all, you have to ask yourself benefit of taking map control at a specific time, and what's the investment requirement of taking map control? And does the benefit of taking map control justify the investment into doing so? So imagine for a second that it's not a great easy timing to take map control for your race, but given the fact that you've seen your opponent is doing something unusual or different than they might otherwise be doing, and that they have a weaker position for taking map control, you gain the ability to invest a significant amount more than normal at a bad timing to take map control from your opponent. Then he can't do anything because of his strategy choice. Well, okay, so that's... you can take map control expensively doing that. Is it worth it? Well, it really depends... on whether or not you're going to get any benefit out of it. So imagine for a second that you can take map control, but to do so takes so many resources you can't afford to drop a command center while doing it, or a new hatchery, without risking losing the map control. So you're just barely taking it, and it's very close, and your opponent is just barely seeing what you have and backing up and letting you have it. But if you stop making units for a second, he might be able to just push out and you lose map control again. Is it necessarily worth it then if you don't get any advantage?
Well, like I said,
if you bring investments into the picture, it becomes so much more complex to discuss. Like, I was just assuming you're there with your army, and it's a reasonably big effective army for that phase of the game and period, not actually having to deviate your investments and strategy to take map control, if that makes any sense.
Okay. So I will adjust my original statement. If you are not changing your strategy at all, and you can take map control without hindering anything else, then it is in fact always 100% good to take map control if your opponent just gives it to you. Right. That is true. However, if your opponent isn't going to automatically cede map control to you, or it takes a deviation to take it, or you have to go back and, or your original strategy is to take it at a time where it wouldn't be easy to do so, is it necessarily actually a good thing to do it?
Well, okay. So when you explain it like that, I'll go back to my original definition, which is the point of map control is that it's a tool to secure objectives. Right, and so when you're map control is not—it's not a goal; it's a tool.
I was going to say the same thing. The goal isn't to get the map, but the map control. The goal is to kill your opponent, right? You want to mess it. You want to, yeah, it's just another tool.
This is how Jer plays chess too, with a knife in their throat. So, he doesn't want to defeat them; he wants them dead and buried.
Yeah, it's one of those things where you're not you don't want to invest in a map control if you're not gaining anything by it.
Right. Yeah. I think that's a very basic economic concept, but
yeah, a good example is when Protoss goes DTs and commentator doesn't do anything and commentator say, "Well, he could take map control, it's fine." It never is. That's bullshit.
DTs are so outrageously expensive.
Exactly. That's a good example of map, like, investing too much in quote-unquote map control, which doesn't even work because the other guy gets detection and he's fine. But anyway, even if they did give you map control, it wouldn't be worth it because they are so ridiculously expensive compared to just having map control.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'll agree with that. So when is it advantageous to do so? Well, Chris mentioned that the purpose of map control is to secure objectives. I'm going to add an addendum to that and say, or to deny your opponent objectives.
Yeah, it's beneficial for yourself, and it's also detrimental to them. There's two whole parts to the map control thing.
Even if you're not planning on securing an objective, if you think your opponent is, it can still be worth it to take map control if you hurt him enough by delaying him and preventing him. Mm-hmm. A notion... I can't remember what the exact strategy was. I remember seeing a while ago a Zerg player who did a big Zergling rush against a Terran. Did a roach rush against a Terran off two bases and denied the Terran's natural with it and just sat a whole bunch of roaches outside the natural. And then kept him in his own base for a while. And then rather than expanding himself with the new map control he had secured, he then just made a whole bunch of banelings over like the next 3 to 4 minutes. He didn't just immediately baneling bust. He then just built up a large group of banelings and then went in again. Because he knew that his opponent... Because he didn't secure an objective for him, but he denied his opponent an objective to the point where his opponent could no longer properly defend it.
Yeah.
Sounds like a very Zerg thing to do.
Sounds like one of those stupid, retarded Hiva builds.
Exactly.
Dude, you say that about Hiva builds, but they worked.
They were all based around like his opponent like being... Like, I have no information, so this is like a 50-50 chance of working.
Yeah, but he had like
and
six
Protoss
different layers
isn't
of that.
Like that.
That's true. But Protoss looks less bullshit.
But Hiva was doing it like Inception levels. Like he had a 50-50 coin flip in a 50-50 coin flip in a 50-50 coin flip, and only one of them needed to work.
Oh my god.
Yeah, Tefl against MPP, never forget. Another good example of not using map control particularly well.
Yeah, that was rough.
I'm going to do a roach bust and then stay on 35 drones for the whole game.
Just continue to roach bust.
Yeah.
So denying your opponent's objectives is a very big part of map control. It also denies your opponent information, as we mentioned before. So a DT rush, for example, is not typically a good idea for taking map control. But if you can take map control and then go DTs, it makes the DTs much stronger.
They're much less likely to know about them. I have a great Brood War story about this.
All right, go.
So basically, here it goes. The very last pro match in 1v1 Brood War was Jangbi versus Fantasy. Jangbi was up 2-1. And in the very last game, he went 10-15 gate, which basically is a gateway timing with Dragoons. And normally Protoss expands behind it, he went DTs. And because he had map control from the 10-15 rush, he actually won with the DTs. And the last game of the last OSL was a successful DT rush, which is just hilarious.
Ladies and gentlemen, we almost made it an hour and a half without a Food War game reference from Teo.
It had to happen eventually. Okay, there's everything. There's Protoss bullshit, map control, and that's it.
And we had some significant Zerg mining. We had some Zerg mining too.
Yeah. Well, that's always going to be there.
From you, yep. Yeah. So, I feel like we've covered most of it. Does anyone have anything else to add?
I like how we're ending with the Brood War story.
Yes, I mean, coming back to our roots, right?
Yeah.
Those roots. Alright,
so
do we have any questions?
Let's have a conclusion first before we take questions on when it's good and bad to take map control. So, do we all agree that it's good to take map control when the investment is worth the objective you're securing or denying?
Yes.
100%, yeah.
Okay, but it's not, or if it's, so when somebody just cedes you map control and you just have an army anyway, you can take it because there's no investment requirement. So obviously an advantage for nothing is a good call. But if you have to go out of your way to take it, only do so when there's an objective to deny or take for yourself. Okay. So do we have any questions?
Was there anything from the Twitter?
Oh, we answered that one about the zone logging powers.
That was the main one we got.
Questions throughout the chat too. Yeah.
Yep.
All right.
Okay, so
I guess speaking
of
chapter questions.
Yep. So Mavis has a question here. Speaking of Brood War, what about hybrid map control like tank mines and Dragoon observers? So that exists in StarCraft 2 as well. Like frequently.
Kind of, yeah.
Yeah, I feel like those are multiple tools for map control.
Map control doesn't have to be a specific unit. It can be a composition. So one of the more effective Protoss map control tools that existed in Wings of Liberty and only kind of existed as a timing and a very cheesy one in Heart of the Swarm was Zealot Archon. So you could go Zealot Archon, which was a very lean and cost-efficient unit composition that had very strong timings in the mid-game, and it basically said to your opponent, get off the map entirely or die. Because if he was out on the map and not behind a building wall, you killed him. You just flat-out killed him at that timing. So right now, you can still do Zealot Archon, but it's more well-known how to respond to it. Mines are very, very good against it. Zerg can defeat it easily if they detect it and aren't out of the map at a bad timing. All they have to do is sit in their base and get a conclave. Protoss. Get a concave against it, or make the correct unit choices, and so on and so forth. Zealot Archon can work against Zerg if Zerg is ignoring everything you're doing and just going with his own specific strategy and trying to kill you, and then you just catch him by surprise. But it's not good or common to really do it much. Against Terran, you pretty much just have to hope that he doesn't see it coming and does not get behind his building walls, because if he does, he's going to make Widow Mines, and then he's going to add on more bio units, and then he's just going to outscale your composition. Zealot Archon does not scale well in numbers. He can make ghosts, which
just rip that apart.
Which just laugh hysterically. But the point is a timing map control composition that doesn't work if you only have one of the two units. Zerg has Zergling, Baneling, Muta. At that timing in the game where they have that composition, they can't control anything of the map at all, really, if with just Zerglings or just Banelings or just Mutalisks. Even Ling Muta has a lot of trouble without the Banelings. But with it, they can easily control their half of the map pretty well.
Yeah.
What about the creep aspect? We never talked about creep.
Ooh.
In map control. Yeah.
Okay, so creep, doesn't specifically helps with map control because it makes your units faster and therefore makes them better suited to holding map control.
It gives vision.
Or control of the area.
Yeah,
and it gives vision. But as we noted before with like observers, vision isn't necessarily control necessarily if you don't have the units to follow up on.
Oh, definitely
it.
Not. But vision, I feel, plays probably the biggest part in having map control.
For Zerg is different though, because between the speed boost and the vision, it gives Zerg such an easier time engaging. Like, no Protoss has ever thought, his units are underneath an observer, that makes my fight so much better. But every Zerg thinks, he's on creep, I'm gonna fuck him up right now.
Yeah, the just, speed boost. The speed boost is huge.
You know, yeah, it's a combination of the vision and the speed boost that makes it so strong for Zerg, so easy for Zerg to control their side of the map if they're spreading creep properly.
But creep is better. Is more. I would say creep is more useful for denying your opponent from taking control of the map than it is for really securing control yourself. Because unless you have the entire map covered in creep, it's not helping you control that much space on your opponent's side of the map, really. It's not really preventing your opponent from moving out.
I think the biggest issue is it just like it prevents like the opponent from moving onto it, because like they move out on the creep and they're like, oh fuck, this is a dangerous area, you know?
Right, to the area where the creep is.
Yeah, so you get this kind of like fear factor that goes on.
Yeah, so it's not really the physical impact of the creep. It also comes into the psychological impacts too.
Well, it's not psychological per se, because you know that if you engage a Zerg on creep, he will likely fuck you up. Unless you're ahead already.
You see, like, Bomber do it all the time, just moves out on creep and demolishes Zergs, too, I mean.
Yeah,
and all the time, he also moves his horde,
so much harder.
And he does, and about half the time, he also moves out on creep, and instead of demolishing the Zerg, he just gets rolled over by a bunch of Banelings and dies. Like, when he's doing that without vision, he's making a gamble that his opponent doesn't have units ready in a position, which, for Bomber, works well, because Bomber's strategic playstyle is to invest more heavily in production and raw units, and delay tech and upgrades a little bit in order to get a slightly higher unit count a little bit faster, and then pressure with those. So opponents who practice against more standard builds will expect a few less units and have optimized for that unit count, and they'll get rolled over by a few, and the few extra units give them a critical mass to roll them over. But people who are prepared for that just roll them over, can defend it without too much trouble. It's not... His micro is really good, which helps, but...
Yeah.
I think creep is actually the best example of how strong map control is, because if you look at the game and you see the Zerg having the entire map covered in creep except the two or three bases of his opponent, your first thought is the other guy is completely dead. Mm. Or one of your first thoughts. It's that strong, assuming the rest of the game is even. Like, if the entire map is covered in creep, the Zerg wins.
Yeah,
okay, because map control is that good.
Yeah. So we have a question here from J727, and I think we all pretty much agree with that, too. Is there actually real map control when the opponent has units like Mutalisks and Speed Medivacs? Because regardless of what you do, those units will always be faster in your base, I think he means to your base, than you can get home with your own army. It's similar to how I mentioned Hellions can just backstab if you leave your own base. That is true. But remember, we differentiated between ground control and air control earlier. You can have complete control of the ground and not have any control of the air. And just because you can control, you do absolutely have to consider that your opponent backs you. And so, no, you don't. If your opponent has units like Mutalisks and you don't have air control, you don't really have map control. If you can't deny the Mutalisks from getting in, you don't really have control of the map.
Okay.
It strongly depends on the situation. If you look at PVTs from about 2013, when Protoss were going blink into, or Robo even, into Templar styles without robotics, that style is actually, the way that style works is you can never attack with it on the map, just only attacking, because Templar are your main damage dealers, and they're also the slowest unit, so they will never catch bio if they kite you. But
they're better on defense than on offense.
On paper, but, and this is the massive thing that people figured out in 2012-13, if you actually have like a War Prism in his main, or you can pull his army out of position and you see where the Medivacs are, then you can move across the map and insta-win, basically, because the Terran is pushed back against a base, and then you storm really easily. It was actually a really cool dance to watch between two good players of trying to move Zealots to harass against the Terran wanting to push into the Protoss, but not overextending and dying to storms. And in that case, the Protoss, with just really good unit movement and harassment, could get map control enough to push across the map and win the game. So yeah, there can be, I think, a situation where you do have map control. It's a short timing, but there can be a really small window where you do have map control, despite Mutas or Medivacs. Mutants are similar too. There was a game in 2012 between Rain and DRG in the OSL, in the first OSL finals on Antigua, where DRG went Mutalisk for the first time in the series, and Rain was on three bases and Blinkstalkers, and what he did was, instead of going Storm, he made three DTs, sent them to three separate bases, and the instant he saw the Mutas kind of pulling back, he moved across the map, so when the Mutas turned around to go back to harass, they ran into Blinkstalkers and Rain won the game. So you can, despite, even though you, the, your opponent can have a really quick unit, you can manipulate that unit and hit a ridiculously small timing window to move across the map. It's a really hard thing to do, but it is possible.
So, to he's correct. To expound on his, with a more general statement to explain what he's trying to say, if you're, so sometimes people have an illusion of being able to move on the map when they really can't. If you can initiate a base trade with your opponent, and win that, and concisively, and conclusively win that base trade, then you really are the one who has map control, even if it looks like your opponent has it. If he sent Mutalisk to your map base and you can't physically stop the Mutalisk from going into your base, but you can send your army across the map to kill him, then the reality is that he has the defensive priority and you have the aggressive priority. If he attacks, he dies. He loses, so he can't attack. He might not know that and might go for it anyway, and you might not know the fact that you're the one with real map control, in which case you won't execute properly and you're not playing as well as you could. But yeah, if you can force your opponent to just just kill your opponent, that doesn't really matter what he does, right?
Right. I think the easiest way to answer this question is just to ask Jeremy what happens when he fucks up and sends on a drop and something horrible happens instead.
I quit the game.
No, but seriously, what happens when you do like a big doom drop or whatever? Like you see someone moves out and you like do a big doom drop. Like what happens that could go wrong?
When I do the drop, what could go wrong?
Yeah.
I can fly into Medivacs or something. Or if I get the drop off successfully, I just kill them.
Oh, okay. So it always works. What you're saying is you have no...
Yeah, big doom drops. Yeah, okay, well, yeah.
Okay, so speed Medivacs always win.
Every TBD, pretty much.
You can manipulate Mutalisk, but not Medivacs.
I can tell you from experience that what Jeremy does when you kill off SCV 3 base all in, Jera 3rd base, kills it, barely doesn't finish the game off, and then loses in a like 20 more minutes of macro play.
Yeah, about right.
He's got a pretty clean record against me, to say the least. I actually have a question for you guys. I want to know your opinions. So what do you think is more important or better? The ground control or air control?
Timing. Depends on what time of the game. It also depends on the matchup.
Okay, we'll use... Well, it's more of just a general question, I guess. Okay, we'll talk... Man, it's, I don't know. Hard to think of a...
Yeah,
it also depends on map features.
Right now, but...
I would prefer ground control most of the time. Just because, like we were talking about with Mutalisk and Medivacs and things like that. You can still manipulate them in some ways. Like, for instance, you know, if the Mutaflock is harassing on one side of the map, you know that you can send out a safe drop on the other side of the map. The Mutalisk won't pick it off. Versus, like, on ground, like, if you don't have ground map control, like, you just can't send... so much harder to send things out because your opponent has a lot of vision and a lot of...
Right, to counter that, imagine your Protoss with a Phoenix play and you have some observers on the map, right?
Mm-hmm.
Your opponent, you can cede ground control and still like zoom around with your Phoenix harassing because you'll see his ground units coming with your observers and you'll never be able to catch your Phoenix with them.
True. I'm just saying I prefer ground control.
Right, I understand.
That's just a personal preference.
My answer to that question is it depends on map features heavily. We talked about this earlier, how certain map features will favor air control over ground control and vice versa. Like, if there's a lot of airspace... ground control becomes significantly more limited because you can't fight or do anything in that airspace against air units with the ground units. So things like the map heavily features it. Also, the more spread out the bases are, the more I prefer air control because air units are more mobile than ground units. It takes a much faster ground unit to be on par with an air unit in terms of mobility. Because you just ignore terrain features with air units, so you can bounce back and forth between bases more easily.
Yeah, so basically it's just really situational.
Okay. Yeah, that's good. That's good. I'm just wondering what you guys were thinking. I myself, I tend to favor probably air, as Joel said. Just how air units can just ignore the textures on the ground and fly anywhere, pretty much.
Plus banshees.
Yeah, and provide, yeah, banshees are great. Plus they provide vision everywhere too, so I mean...
Fair enough.
I would side a bit to the air. But yeah, of course, the map features also heavily influence the impact of ground versus air control. So yeah.
So it sounds like we've pretty much covered everything then. Anyone have anything else to add?
No, I think I'm pretty much good. Anybody in chat?
We'll wait a bit and see if there's any more questions, but that should probably be it.
I guess now's a good time to do any plugging.
shameless plugs.
As promised, Chris, I held off on the random game theory talk involving Nash Equilibrium and so on and so forth this
you.
Week.
Thank you. I'm just going to do a shameless self plug real quick. I'm at esports_John, and recently I've been doing League of Legends, so I know most people don't really like League of Legends here, because we're all prejudiced against it.
Yeah, next episode's not about unit design, it's about League of Legends.
But occasionally I do stream League of Legends, and I'm not great yet, but I'm trying. And it's also at this stream location as well, so...
All right, so that aside, thanks for the self-plug, Chris. all that aside, next episode we will be discussing unit design. So I believe we'll have another Team Liquid Strategy team member with us, Zeramis, with us next time. He seemed to indicate he'll be off vacation by then. It's too early to promise if we'll have any pro guests on with us, but it seems promising that we might.
Looking forward to that
for a unit design episode. So that's about where we're at
Special
right now.
Special guest David Kim.
Yeah, right.
If I could pick his brain and get him to sit down and actually just straight up talk without the PR, I'd be. You have no idea how excited I'd be.
Yeah,
it's never gonna happen.
I wouldn't even be like aggressive or antagonistic towards his answers, even if I didn't like him. I'd just be like, let's talk game theory, David. but all things considered, I think his job is a lot more difficult than people give him credit for, and I think he does the best job he can try to do. And just because we don't like the conclusions he comes to doesn't necessarily mean that he's not good at his job. It just means that they may have different goals than we do. So yeah, all things aside, that's about where we're at. So we'll all see you guys 2 weeks from now for the next episode.
And that's going to be on unit design. See you guys later.
Adios. Yep.